Anybody tells you money's the root of all evil doesn't have any. They say money can't buy happiness. Look at the f***ing smile on my face.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new... So, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
The f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Well, no back Station Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. Warm day here in Chicago. I guess that's good. See how many shootings we have. Always a negative to everything. Do we have Professor Bill?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. How are you? S&P futures down 6, NASDAQ futures down 24 after two pretty huge up days after appearing to turn the clock back on this tariff stuff, or at least saying that. And all of a sudden, we like Powell. We're not going to fire him tomorrow. So we've had an awful lot of, without being accusatory, shall we say, market-moving announcements out of the government in the last, well... Kind of for a while now, but certainly in the last few weeks, few months. Not sure what to make of that, other than the fact that somebody's making money on it. What kind of deal? We also had we've had almost a 10% move, which Greg will talk to, in the currency, and which most people goes right over their head and eyes gloss over on that. That's a big deal. It's a big deal. I mean, bigger than 10% move in the stock market in terms of money being lost. Bill, we had you were off building water plants and so forth back when we were doing all these seminars, right? For back in those days, people really wanted to learn all about options and trade. Now it's sort of different. People really don't want to learn. They either think they know it all, or they get it from the internet, or they have somebody manage their money and just go along and hope it goes up. I mean, people are not as into it. I mean, Greg, remember all the technical people that we try and doing stuff on the futures side, and there are a lot of people teaching people stuff, and people are dying to learn. And it seems like not like nobody today doesn't want to learn, but it's kind of not the same. But Bill, we had a group up. We were pretty tight with the people from Mexico. One of the people did some business here with PTI. Was big on doing stuff down there, and the Options Institute, where Russell worked for a long time. Was the educational arm of the options industry. It started at the CBOE, and then all the exchanges became a piece of it. And anyway, they did a lot of, that's why Russell did a lot of that traveling overseas, was because the Options Institute was holding classes in places like China and Vietnam and places how to open up exchanges, future, well, mostly options, but, you know, whatever they were trying to open up. And we ended up being pretty tight, we, meaning PTI, pretty tight with these people from Mexico. Up the chain in Mexico, and they were interested in putting together a futures exchange and an options exchange, and the Options Institute was down there, and sometimes my brother and Dr. J would go. I never went. I'm not sure why I never went, but those guys always kind of held down the fort, and those guys went, and were pretty tight. And we had a seminar up here. We're probably 8 to 10 of the people, Bill, were pretty serious guys from Mexico, right? This is in the 90s, back when Mexico used to devalue their currency every once in a while. You remember those days. And so we had our seminar for the week, and of course, every Friday night, we'd go down to Excelsior, which was open at the time, and they'd pour these 4-ounce drinks, and you kind of heard everything from everybody, right, as a few of those went down the hatch. And they just devalued their currency that week. Greg, you're going to find this bizarre story. So I said, you know, I feel bad for you guys. Your currency got devalued. It's devalued like 8 or 10%. This one guy who was pretty connected goes, what the bleep are you talking about? just like our lead in. And I go, well, isn't that not good for everybody? Well, it depends. Because if you know it's coming, you move your money offshore the night before into dollars and come back, you got 10% more pesos the next day than the guy next door. And I'm going, whoa. I never quite thought of it that way. I didn't know people got to do that, but evidently, if you're connected enough, you sort of do. So don't assume that when these policy changes don't just appear out of nowhere, that somehow somebody doesn't get the idea, well, that's not good for the dollar. So if somebody would have taken his $100 million, you know, a guy retired like Bill, and said, you know, I'm going down to the bank tonight and I'm turning it into euros, and 3 weeks later you turn it back to dollars, guess what? You just made 10%, right?
You know, my observation, and I'm certainly no expert in any of this stuff, but I do pay attention to the euro because I'm going to Ireland this summer. And I want to say 2 months ago, the exchange rate on the euro was $1.02.
It got down
and
that low.
I looked at it yesterday. It's $1.14.
Yeah, it was. It got down to $1.02. That was brief. It's been 108 for like a real long time. And then it went to 14. But you're right. It made it to 102 in like, was it January?
Seems like that. And I was going to ask you, Tom, what would do that? Why is that?
Well, a lot of it is difference in exchange rates. I mean, interest rates in the various countries. And it could be tariffs. It's basically demand for the other person's... For somebody here who is buying stuff from Europe is either going to get a forward contract or they're going to want to buy it today. So you're going to be... It's all in terms of... people want the euros and not the dollars. It's a supply and demand. That's the one thing that it's really, really hard to learn. Well, it was for me, the University of Chicago... Because, you know, Bill, we're both Midwesterners. We got the buckos in our pocket. That's all we ever knew, right? But people in Europe know all the time, especially before there was a euro. Every time you turn around, you were changing currencies, right? You're going from Austria to Germany to France. And they're pretty adept at this. Why would we know anything about currencies unless once in a while you went to Canada, right?
Right.
So there I am in class at the University of Chicago, and they're talking about this stuff. I don't know anything. And there's a few guys in there that are from Europe. They get it all figured out on day one. And I'm thinking, what am I doing in this class? They're talking about, okay, if this happens, if this tariff comes up, or if this particular country raises their interest rate, all of a sudden people want to put their money over there because now you earn interest more over there, so it's a better currency to have. I'm sitting there going, what are these people talking about? And yet immediately the guys from Europe are going, yeah, credit delineator, their stuff's going to go up, and credit Anstalt's going down. And I'm going, where do you learn? It took a while to catch up, to say the least, because we're not usually versed in that. I mean, you probably have a better feel, and that's one of the reasons why I asked you on today. If you start doing a project overseas, this is a big deal, right? And I also want to talk to you, just a list of stuff so I don't forget them. What happens, I've been watching, we have a lot of stock here from Accenture and a couple other places that we have concentration issues on people. And I've been watching these consulting firm stocks, especially Accenture, just get its ass kicked. I mean, it was 380 8 weeks ago, now it's 280, 286. And, you know, then the Chinese come out and they start talking about part of their, if they're going to fight us on tariffs, it's not just going to be on goods, it's going to be on services. And they're going to essentially boot some of these consulting firms out of there, which got to be law firms, and well, Accenture's a big consulting firm on systems and something. And you had mentioned when you were on the show one day about some of these engineering firms have how many thousands of people working for them and do business in all these different countries. And I just wanted maybe to start to take us, I mean, I'll tell you how Pullman used to do it. I'll take 2 minutes to do that, then you can kind of tell me what the stages of a project are essentially overseas and who pays what who. I mean, when Pullman did it, for those that don't know, Pullman obviously made railroad cars, but they also had Pullman Trailmobile, which made truck trailers, and they also had Pullman Kellogg, which is now part of Kellogg Brown and Root, and they did, I believe they did refineries and stuff was a strong part of their game, Bill, but something like that. And then there was Pullman Swindell, I don't know who's got them, but they made stacks, don't call them chimneys, stacks, big, huge, you know, look like chimneys to most people, but they're stacks. And I don't know who the hell's got them, but a lot of this stuff went through the Import-Export Bank, and Robin did some of that work, where you would go out, and all this money was run through Pullman. That's why they had such a huge banking thing, where if Saudi Arabia or somebody like that wants to build a, or somebody in Saudi Arabia wants to build a refinery, or Oman or any place, wherever it is, could be Spain, Kellogg would get the engineering on it. And somehow, I don't know if you needed Import-Export Bank for Spain, maybe you did. The financing would come from maybe the Import-Export Bank, and some banks would loan money, and maybe you get money from the sovereign group over there. But there was a profit center. I mean, when you were done, you had a refinery that made money. And I don't know if anybody ever got stiffed. I mean, I'm not talking about thousands of things I knew about, but a few. It wasn't like China putting in a road, you know, type of thing. But these were all... might have been a water treatment plant that had a separate taxing thing for it. It could have been something. And this all worked through the Import-Export Bank, through Pullman's banks, and the engineering went through Kellogg, even though the entire cost of the refinery went on Pullman's income statement, even though, you know, it could have been $5 million for the place, using a small number. And Pullman Kellogg made, you know, $200,000. So it would go in there as $5 million minus expenses of $4.8 million, and we ended up with $200,000, we being Pullman, when in fact $200,000 was the fee. But that's what happened in those days. All these places were done in these countries by outside engineering firms. I mean, because I don't think anybody in Saudi Arabia back then knew how to build a refinery or anything like that. And you mentioned that these projects are all going on around the world now. I mean, people building dams use people from here, right, and so forth. How does, in today's world, how does something like that get financed? I mean, is it all the Chinese government? Could they boot you guys out halfway through the dam construction? I don't know how they could do that. And take us through how something like that works with these big, huge firms.
Well, I'm going to use an example that I'm not really an expert on, but probably is pretty applicable in China. Let's say that they wanted a hydroelectric dam. So that would be a pretty high capital cost thing. And, you know, the first effort in the project would be to do a study. You know, let's see the feasibility of the project, how much power can be generated, location of the dam, displacement of the people, on and on and on, and get to a number. You know, how much is this thing going to cost? Is it viable? And then let's assume that some part of China needs this electricity.
All right, but that contract is just a straight out X number of hours, 50 guys a year.
Yeah, right. Study contract, and if you're the engineering firm, and if you're the least bit suspicious of not being paid, I would simply say, we'll take our fee 100% day one.
Yeah.
And generally, they're looking for the expertise in the U.S. in many things. And I should mention, I went to China. Oh, it was 9 years ago, right after I retired. I was invited over there to talk to the Chinese about various water things, water efficiency primarily. So for 10 days, I trotted around China. And not to insult anybody from China or anything, because I was kind of open-minded, I wasn't super impressed with the whole place.
Don't tell me what your Southside route you ordered chop suey.
Yeah. I did, with an old style beer.
And, oh, God.
I went around, and we were kind of like dignitaries, you know, so they were showing us stuff, and they showed us things, and they were like super blown away with something they would do that I'll be honest with you, I'd look at it as kind of like a landscaping job. I'm like, this is not a big deal, but you wouldn't say that. You would just agree, oh yeah, everything wonderful. So, but I remember them telling me a story when I was there, and they were super into impressing you with that, hey, we're way ahead, you know, we're moving fast and we're doing things. And they said, I was sitting around one day with some of the people that spoke English, not many people do, and they were telling me, so, you know, we're going to build our first jet airliner completely. I said, really? I mean, have you all built like little planes and you're working your way up? No, we're just jumping into the 747. We're going to build our own 747. When does that happen? I said, well, like a couple months from now. And I was kind of, it sounded funny. And like a lot of things when I was over there sounded a little funny like that. So obviously I left the country, and but I sort of kept track of this some way on the internet and, you know, new plane. And what I kind of discerned about the building the airplane from scratch is they bought a bunch of components from Boeing, and I think they had Boeing come over and bolt it together in China, and that was their thing.
Well, which, I think that their shtick... I know part of I've read. I mean, I don't know. I'm not Mr. Boeing, but I think when the 787 came out, they wanted to build a piece of it because they ordered so many of them, and I think they ended up building the tail, or something like that. But they demanded, and you can, I suppose, as an engineer, you would say there's some truth to it. I think they demanded the drawings of the whole plane as part of the deal,
so they could copy them.
I think where you're going with this, anticipating having the drawings and being able to do the process is two totally light years different things, aren't they? I mean,
yeah, I mean that gives you a clue, but yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say you've got the keys to the kingdom there with just the drawings. So,
no, I mean, I remember at Pullman, the guys I thought were the most amazing, and I don't know what. When you build a water treatment plant, who does this? But some engineer would come out with a drawing, and a parts list would be on the drawing. This is, you know, this is old school, and
right.
And all of a sudden you'd hand it to a manufacturing engineer, and you might say, "Who's he?" He sits there and looks at the drawing, looks at the parts, and he goes, "Okay, first thing you do, operation number one, take part A, bolt it together to part B," and it just envisions the construction of the whole thing, where the engineer, I think, just envisions the thing being done, you know, and what it's going to look like and all the parts. I don't know if he, and then the manufacturing guy goes, well, if you're going to get to that, if you're going to build that wall, you take this 2x4 and you nail it to this 2x, and all of a sudden you have, you know, 200 different, they call them processes or work, whatever the term was, and when you were done, you had the side of a car. I mean, who does that for, like, a plant? If somebody... you know, somebody gets the engineering and says, okay, here's all the stuff that's got to go into this water treatment plant. Who says, okay, wait a minute, first thing you do is dig this hole here, and start with the concrete there. I mean, I always was so fascinated with that.
Well, in the U.S., we've got people that do these things every day, and they are top-notch. And going on with our China example, my guess is, if we go back to my hydroelectric dam, that probably all the sophisticated parts of the project are done by U.S. people, and when the and the construction work is done locally with their people, but they're overseen by U.S. engineers. You know, people from America would move there for a decade and watch over the construction of the dam and the power facilities and all the stuff. I mean, this thing would never get out of the reach of the real smart people here. And in terms of the financing, I presume the government of China would have the money, unless there is some international organization that wants to make a loan or give them a grant to do something if they think they're helping poor people or whatever they're doing. But again, when I wandered around that place for 10 days, and I was in I think I was in six cities. And every city that I was in was bigger than Chicago. I mean, the smallest city I was in was 10 million people. And there were a couple I was in that were 30 million.
Yeah, the your buddy, the Mayor Daley, he used to be a member of the club up here when he was mayor. I used to talk to him all the time. Actually, my brother Dan and he were like, they were like bros because they were the two guys working out every Saturday by themselves. So they'd be sitting on the extra cycles next to each other BSing. But I talked to him once in the steam room, and he was saying that he went over there, and he said all these cities are like, I think at the beginning of the 20th century, which would be 1901, right? I think Chicago was one of the 3 million people was one of the top 10 biggest cities in the world. And now there's, like you say, there's how many cities in China that are way over 3 million people and way bigger than Chicago?
Yeah, when you get over there, you are immediately struck, or at least I was, with how many people are running around. It is like when you're just walking down the street at 7 in the morning, these streets are just teeming with people. But the other thing that I was struck by, and whatever, let's say they put us in fairly nice hotels, and the hotels were pretty nice.
Did you find that intimidating? I mean, you're a big guy, so I know one of the ladies, not to get off subject, but I always do that, who bartends at the Triple A, a good friend of mine. She's been there forever, and well, she's kind of an owner. And she loves to go to these different places around the world, and she says, I was in India, and just walking down the street, it was like I was... You know, I was getting on an L platform. The street is just so crowded. If somebody wanted to grope you or whatever, you're just lost in the sea of humanity. She goes, I felt so uncomfortable.
Well,
I couldn't wait. I couldn't wait to get out of
there. Americans, you know, as white people with white skin, and somebody actually told me this. They said, don't be surprised if people react to you just walking around. And I remember the first day I left my hotel and I was going to walk around a little bit, and I could see a group of younger Chinese people walking opposite me, coming at me, and I could tell that they were talking about me, that they were like, uh-oh, what's this guy? And of course, because I'm a little bit on the tall side, stick out even more in China. And as they got closer, and they spoke no English, I spoke no Chinese, they started waving their hands a little bit to get my attention, and they held up their cell phones to give me the indication that they wanted me to take a picture of them. No, they wanted somebody else to take a picture of them standing with me.
They probably thought you were an ex-NBA player.
Well, I don't think they did. But in the course of the 10 days I was over there, I had this experience over and over again where I was in a restaurant and I have a few freckles on my face, owing those to the Emerald Isle. And
Bill is about the most Irish looking guy you've ever come across, for those. Go ahead.
Well, people would come up without permission. They thought freckles were so interesting that they would just come up and touch your face.
Oh, God.
And and of course, when you're like, first time that one happens, you're like, what are we doing? You know, what's going on here? Also, if you're a woman with blonde hair, I believe, they will come up to you without permission and just start not pulling your hair, not harming you, but feeling your hair. It's kind of something to do. And the last day I was there, I was eating breakfast in like a coffee shop in one of these places. And I'm sitting there eating my scrambled eggs, and a lady comes over with an infant. And she stands at the side of my breakfast table, and she can't talk to me. She speaks Chinese, I only speak English. And she's gesturing that she wants me to hold the baby. Like,
just don't drop. Don't drop them.
Don't drop. So she hands me her child, and takes a picture of me holding the child, and then scoops up her child. And so it's a whole little strange world over there.
I hope she didn't say grandpa.
Yeah. God. I was glad she didn't give me the baby and then leave.
Yeah. Then what would you have done if she would have handed you the baby and took off?
Right. That would have been scary. But the other thing about the place, I thought when you looked out your hotel window, there was nothing green about the place. There was no park. There was no lake. It was nothing but towers, like the housing projects in Chicago. These 20, 30, 40-story towers, and there were no end to them. And half of them were not occupied. They were built. They were done. No lights on. You could see through them. And of course, they had... Every city had 40 tower cranes in the sky building more of this stuff. It was sort of like government, you know, they had crews to build buildings, and they just kept building them whether they needed them or not. And it was kind of not a very appealing environment. That was my...
Well, Chris Manzi used to do the show with us. He did some work. Matter of fact, he was pretty tight. He and his wife were pretty tight with the Department of Agriculture here. And they would, Department of Agriculture, I assume, would pay them or would pay the expenses to have people from China come over here. I mean, even though, you know, on the top end of the politics, you know, and maybe I'm not a big fan of Z, you know, we might, hopefully not, but hope we have to fight these guys someday, but let's hope that doesn't happen. On the lower end, there actually was always a lot of cooperation. And they brought people over, and they were in our offices here for 2 weeks. There were probably four or five guys, four or five girls. There were, you know, 10, 12 people are over here from their corresponding Department of Agriculture. And these are, you know, the kids of people that are somewhat in the party and so forth. And so Chris went over there a couple times, and he come back and tell me some of the stuff he ate. And I'm going, you know, you don't need to do that for whatever. But he said that, you know, the average family plot was like an eighth to a quarter of an acre or something, you know, for a few chickens and maybe a cow. And when the amount of people from the agrarian areas moved to the city, that's where all these people came from in the city. I mean, there's this one girl told me that she spoke fluent English. She must have gone to school here, maybe. Said that the first thing she did was got a train ticket and took a, I don't know, 12-hour train ride to Beijing and never went back. And eventually, I mean, she's very attractive. I mean, I'm sure that maybe that helped, but she's also very bright. She worked her way up, and now she was in their Department of Agriculture over here for 10 days. And Chris and this group did, I tell you what was fun. Well, I went on a barge tour of Illinois River. Went through one of those huge locks. I'd never been in a 200-foot lock before. For God's sake, you're in that thing. You know, the only lock I went through was the one in Lake Michigan, and what's that, like 3 feet? Well, these things, so we went on the barge tour, learned all about barges, and we went to one of the ethanol plants. And the first thing the guy there would say, no pictures, leave all your cell phones here. And boy, you talk about people pissed off. That's all they do is take pictures of everything. But I guess, how can, when the Chinese people say we're going to cut back on the services, maybe you could cut back on some of what Arthur Andersen does, those kinds of systems consulting. But, I mean, aren't law firms huge over there, our law firm? I mean, how do you cut back on that if you got projects going?
I bet you they won't be able to cut back at all, because we're the only ones that know how to do anything. And you could say that, and some high-up government minister could say that, but when it gets down to getting anything done, they're going to have to go back to their regular American ponies and say, okay, guys, we need you back. And because our expertise is... And I would say the Europeans would have some of it as well, but that's really about it for doing these complex projects. If they tried to do any of these things on their own, they would screw it up so bad it'd be a biggest mess ever.
Well, could the engineering firms like you're talking about with these thousands of people, could they just say, okay, we'll pull the American people out and we'll put the British guys in or something? Could you do something squirrely like that?
Maybe, or they would just keep real quiet about it. They would have some arrangement where they don't make it public that they're working on the job. You know, they just kind of do it incognito. Although so many of these firms are publicly held, I don't know how you would keep it a secret. But the Chinese, you know, when I was marching around there for 10 days, they sort of had a pretty good knack of taking credit for stuff. And, you know, like if they did 5% of it and you did 95% of it, they kind of like made it sound like they were the ones that thought everything up. And but they, I mean, I was not impressed with their sophistication at all. I wasn't going over there trying to be Mr. Ugly American at all. I was, my eyes were completely wide open. And, but I didn't see a lot there. I mean, it was kind of on a level of rural Mexico in terms of sophistication. And I'm not saying the people were not smart, and they were, but their technology is not developed. Now, again, I'm not talking about building smartphones and factories, and they may know how to do that like crazy, but the stuff I know how to do, they weren't in the game. At all.
Bill, what do you do with shifting gears a little bit? What about, I'll say, third world projects? I have a client. I don't know how the hell he got me onto this. But as you know, I have curiosity in God knows crazy places. So he had a buddy who had some of these bearer bands from back in the 30s and before. German bearer bands, and then there's Mexican bearer bands. Unlike the U.S., a lot of these countries, even Mexico, issued bearer bands, and when you got a new ruler, they basically said those bands are no good. I mean, there's Santa Ana bands out there and things like that, that if you turn one into a bank, they start laughing at you. But you know, there are people that think someday these things are going to be worth something. I mean, there's German bands that actually were sold. This is what I've mentioned this before. I'll be real brief. After World War One, when the world was pretty much a cluster bleep, Germany could not pay their reparations to Japan, or to Japan, to France and England, right? And France and England were having trouble paying their World War One debts to us. Yet, so the Germans came over here, and they sold gold-backed bearer bonds to the U.S. people. And people here bought them. Now, there's a bank on there where the gold was supposed to be deposited. There's a company that, more, you know, by and large, is still around, that was behind the bonds that the government somehow backed as well. So people here were buying these bonds. The German government was using the dough to pay off France and Britain. They were turning around using the dough to pay off us. And people at the short end of the stick were a lot were American citizens. I mean, you know, you couldn't write fiction like this. So these, I get involved in this stuff, and I'm talking to all these weirdo people all over the world, right? And when I say, well, like 10 people, they're trying to use some of these bonds as collateral for loans for some of these esoteric, like, water treatment projects in, you know, Ghana or someplace. You know, stuff like Bill Gates might be involved in, or some foundation. And they're always looking for money. And one of the guys was telling me, you know, he was pretty bright, and he was saying that if you try and do something like that on your own, without boots on the ground, 90% of the stuff you send over there to build the place is going to disappear. If you've got boots on the ground, maybe only 40% will disappear. Try and get any help from the dictator or anything like that, you know, building the water treatment facility or whatever it is, the sewage facility. And I think some people get some of that money from the UN in some place. That's a huge question. You ever worked on something? How does that work? I mean, when the thing is so slippery to start with and people are stealing stuff, you ever been involved in one of those?
No, but I've heard about these kind of situations. You know, if you've got a security problem, and that could be the health and welfare of the personnel you have working on the job locally, or the materials being stolen, well, you gotta deal with that going in. And I mean, you're going to have to hire a small army to protect everything, and that's just part of the fee, you know, it's part of the job. That, yeah, we'll go build a water treatment plant in the middle of this jungle where we're not safe and our stuff will be stolen, but we're going to hire some retired Navy SEALs to keep us safe while we're down there. You know, and if it's too risky, no one will go. They'll just say, "Yeah, we're not going down there," because nobody's going to send a bunch of Americans down there, a bunch of American engineering people to get shot up. No one's going to even go near that. So I'd be very, very cautious of those kind of things. But I think they happen from time to time.
Well, I mean, wasn't that the big deal in Libya? I mean, I remember you and I were we even in college? When did the when did the Mo Man? I remember Libya, of course, has a lot of oil, right? And I seem to recall them saying, well, you know, it's getting a little dicey there, so maybe if you're not a direct worker in one of these fields, you know, maybe the family should get out of there, and maybe somebody else should get out. They kept upping the danger rhetoric, and finally, like the last day, we still had like 15,000 people there doing God knows what. I mean, they must be making a lot of money putting oil rigs up or something. But there seems like there's a lot of money to be made at some of this stuff if you're willing to take the risk.
Those kind of oil field people are pretty tough customers, in my opinion. A lot of them are from here, where I live here in Texas. So, yeah, you could put them in some dangerous places, and if they're making enough money, they'll all be carrying their weapons and be ready to battle it out and protect the company's facilities for sure. But you know, that's kind of a little different breed, if you ask me. Those kind of wildcat people are willing to do about anything to get that oil out of the ground and make money.
They're not like water treatment engineers that want to kind of safe.
Yeah, we water treatment people, we retreat real quick. we're not making a ton of money in the BMA.
So what is the... I want to talk a little bit about basketball and where we're kind of heading with this. And I got to get you on the list here, because Kevin sent something out yesterday about how many people in the portal. We've been going back and forth about, at some point here, I don't think it's defensible. Whether I think it's right or wrong, it has nothing to do with it. I don't think it's defensible for the NCAA to have rules saying you can only have 4 years of eligibility if you're in college for 6 or 7 years. I think someplace along the way, I think somebody's going to say, "What are you talking about? If a guy's in a 5 year, you know, undergrad slash, or a 6 year undergrad slash medical program, why the hell can't the guy play for 6 years, guy or lady?" And it's funny. Kevin sent this thing out yesterday, and the NCAA, in an attempt to try and get back on pace here, which I think they're so far behind it, I think they're talking about a new rule that says you get 5 years of eligibility, correct? And they've just been talking about it. It's not official. Well, evidently, there's all kinds of people that have entered the portal that have already used up their 4 years of eligibility. So they want to get picked up by another place for the fifth year in case this rule thing comes down. I don't know if you heard about that.
A little bit. I mean, this whole NIL thing is pretty out of control, if you ask me.
Well, it is. Well, by definition, right? It's. I guess you could look at regular society and say it's out of control, right? You can go to any firm you want and get paid. I mean, if you like people being in control, it's out of control. And if somebody calls you tomorrow and says, "Hey, Bill, look, all you got to do is work 3 days a week, you can still golf the other four. We're going to give you $300,000 a year." You can do it tomorrow, right?
I guess I'll be there. Yeah.
I mean, is that out of control, or is that the way it's supposed to be?
Well, I had heard something yesterday that the University of Kentucky basketball program was going to have an NIL budget for this year of $20 million, which is about the most I have heard.
Now, when you say NIL budget, you mean the people on the team are going to get paid $20 million by somebody, or the school itself is going to pay? I don't think the school itself is still, they don't want to consider people employees. Right.
Yeah, I'll beg ignorance to the details, but somebody's putting up $20 million to acquire players for the team, and which I've heard numbers like, you know, 3 to 5 to 6 to 7, but now you're at 20, and of course once Kentucky goes to 20, there'll be a few others that'll have to match. So
we've got 12 people on the team.
Pretty uncompetitive landscape where there's probably 5 or 6 schools that can do that, And but you know, did the team with the most NIL want money win last year? I don't think so. So it's still possible.
Well,
you know?
But they the number four number ones got there.
No question. Yeah.
Question for you. I mean, this is a little off. Maybe you're beaten trail, but I have a feeling that you. I'm going to ask you a subject. If you're sitting on a board of someplace, now Texas, you know, who the hell knows what they think down there, what you guys think, but when you see all this stuff that's happening in football, remember the guy we used to play ball with that, the Quonset Hut? By the way, the Quonset Hut's down, you know. St. Bernadette sold all that stuff to a little company, and it's all down. But remember Joe Noter?
I do, yeah.
Well, big family, and I'm pretty good friends with his brother Nick down here in the trading area. Older brother evidently played, I don't know if he played for Evergreen Park or Marist, one of the two, because Nick and the rest of them went to Marist. And then he went to play for Penn. And I don't even think the guy was, I don't even know if he was a starter. But it wasn't like some massive pro career or anything like that. And he ended up pretty messed up and to the point where, you know, I think he took his own life, unfortunately.
Oh,
and,
no.
And they ended up, you know, winging his brain out to wherever you send it in Boston to find out if you have that disease you get from a gazillion concussions, and he did.
CTE.
Yeah, I mean, and he did. So I'm not sure if you put a rational person like you on the board at Notre Dame or Indiana or any place, if you want to open yourself up, I mean, one solution, instead of dragging, I'll use the term paychecks from Under Armour, Nike, Pete Pizza, Joe's Chevy, and all that stuff, and cobbling it all that together, which you're not supposed to, but people are seemingly are doing it, and coming up with the $20 million at Kentucky. I'll bet out of that 20, Bill, 15 of it is their sponsor, meaning Under Armour or Adidas or Nike. And the rest is some combination of alumni. I might be high with that. Some combination of alumni, local charities, maybe some guys who get together and want these guys to go to a hospital two nights a week and pay them $500 an hour for the 3 hours there or there or something like that. There's some combination of this mess. But would you really want to take, I mean, for basketball it's different, but for football, would you really want to take on the employee workman's comp stuff of these people going forward, knowing what's happened to some of these guys?
Well, they certainly are doing that, and
well, they're not really. They're still not employees.
Oh, when you're saying the university employs them versus the sponsor,
yeah.
Well, I think if they see that risk, they'll clearly let the sponsor do it. I'm sure the sponsor is happy to do it. You know, they're gonna pay the university one way or the other. They either give the money to the school or they give it to some kid to play football, which helps their brand because he's going to wear a jersey with their little swoosh on it or something. I would think those brand name people will be enthusiastically involved.
Well, I mean, they don't want them as their employees, do they? I mean, what could some family?
I mean, are they employees or are they just?
Well, that's,
you know,
what I'm saying. It's the reason why I get there.
People that, and you write some kind of contract that excludes their health. Issues if you can.
Can you do that if you're an employee?
Don't know. That's a lawyer question.
Yeah.
There.
Well, the reason why I asked this is, you remember when we first got out of school, I was on the board of Notre Dame Club of Chicago for a while. And I used to go to the functions, and matter of fact, we ran the party up there for a while. I don't know if you ever came to one of those, but there were riots. We had all these people from the first year we had like six smoking hot girls on the floor. You know, serving beers and stuff to all the old fogies in the private lounge and stuff for the thing. We were hot. Anyway, Tom Tully is a good friend of you remember Jim Doherty, my buddy. He's worked with Tom forever. Anyway, Tom is this big attorney in Chicago, terrific guy, and he knows all these people. So after the shindig, we would go out, and I'm sitting there BSing with none other than George Conner for about 2 hours. You remember that name?
Yep.
And George is he says to me, "Tommy, how many surgeries do you think I've had since I stopped playing football that are football related?" And I go, "Mr. Conner, I have no idea." And he goes, "Try 25. And he, you know, fingers, knees, Not one of them was paid for by Notre Dame or the Bears. And I just wonder, as time goes by, I don't know that the rest of society is going to put up with that. Or, I mean, I think in some ways we haven't. I mean, I don't know that the CTE thing is that some of these teams aren't going to end up being on the hook for some of that. I mean, obviously, your first defense is, oh, no, it didn't happen in pro. It already happened in college. And college is going to say it already happened in high school. And I don't know when some of these settlements start to happen and people find out that they knew about it and ignored it or something. I don't know if you want to be on a board of a high school, for God's sake. I mean, you know, I mean, we all know playing sports, you could get a concussion in basketball. I mean, you could fall back and hit your head in the floor and stuff. But it's not as likely as in football, right? Or maybe even in hockey. What kind of liability are people willing to sign themselves up for, I guess?
I think it's a very complex question. Sports injuries and all these sponsorships. The thing is, it's probably not getting thought through very well. People are just in greed mode, you know. Let's just sign up kids to play sports and let's win the championship. It's a lot of fun. And they're not thinking completely, but I think the kind of questions you're asking need to get answered, because there will be injuries and there will be, you know, problems, and they need to address them.
Well, one of the examples I use is to where this is, you know, one man's opinion, just kind of reading all this stuff and listening to people on the show. I don't think, Bill, the NCAA at this point can just lob out any sort of rules, really, that apply to everybody. Because I think they've been quashed in court. I mean, who the hell are they? They're not bargaining with anybody. They're not doing anything. But what I think might happen, this is me being a half-assed attorney here, what I think might happen is the Big East, for instance, which is, what, 10, 12 schools, I think they could put together a new contract for the players. Now, I'm saying anybody's going to sign it. They could put together a new contract for their people to come there and say, the recruitment of you costs $50,000. Your first 2 years here with strength coaches, people telling you what to eat, tuition, all the other stuff. By the end of year two, when we're probably still not going to be playing yet, by the end of year two, we've got $280,000 invested in you. You owe us two more years, or one more year, or something. I think the Big East could do that. And if you sign that contract as an entering freshman, I think all that would fly. I don't think the NCAA can demand that, but I think a conference. Now, that could mean that and maybe you're going to pay the kid $50,000 a year, $100,000 or $150,000. But I mean, at some point, the schools are not going to just be the poachees. I mean, Miami of Ohio or someplace like that is not going to go get, or Butler, recruit five people and have one of them become a star and immediately go to Alabama and lose the guy. I mean, I don't see that as a long-term. Nobody's going to let that happen forever. I don't think that anybody's that stupid, are they? I think conference by conference, I think now that may mean that the Big East is never going to really be able to compete with the Alabamas and Auburns in the world in the NCAA tournament, which is all the NCAA cares about because that's where they make all their money. I don't know that you'll ever be able to have, you know, five or six people from the Big East in there, but I think the conferences, you have to do it on their own, right? And not just be, you know, put out all this money for people and all of a sudden everybody just takes them all from them for nothing. I mean, nobody's that dumb forever, are they?
I don't know. If you saw the recruiting list for St. John's in the last week, where they have brought on a whole new team of five-star guys, and it wasn't like they were poaching from other conferences. They were grabbing people from the Big East. They were grabbing people wherever. And I presume the
reason... This is Patino, right?
Yeah.
Well, there's your reason.
He's got a big guy writing checks behind him, so he's able to get these kids, and they say, well, we know we're going to have a top five team with the guys that we're recruiting. And remember, that's with getting rid of their best player. If you remember that kid they had in the tournament who they pulled out of the game at the end, who was their star all year, He went to the portal. He's going to go to the NBA. One of the two. So he basically, and Pitino did this last year. He just starts over. Says, okay, we've got so many roster spots. Let's get the best people we can get.
Well, I didn't go
to town.
My little scenario did not address interconference poaching. I don't know what you do with that one. You're gonna have to solve that one. What happens if people start poaching within the conference? But I'm saying, if these people had a contract with the previous school that they can't leave, the reason for it is, I mean, I've said this 10 times, and hopefully I'm not pouring the crap out of people. When I got out of University of Chicago, I went right, I went right there from Notre Dame. It was $3,000 a year, so it was $6,000, and we actually was less than that because I went there in the summer and cut it by a quarter. So I'm saying I paid $5,500 total for a University of Chicago degree, which is way less than one class now. You know, we're talking about, and I recall, even though I went for Allied Van Lines, it was a small place, or Pullman. If you showed up, Bill, as a structural engineer in a railroad car, and you said, oh, by the way, I want to go to University of Chicago at night, they'd say, go, we'll pay. No ifs, ands, or buts. And they'd write the check. You know, I think if you got less than a C, they might want some money back, but other than that, as long as you got some decent grades, everybody's happy. Well, all of a sudden, University of Chicago got to $5,000, $6,000, $10,000. To find a guy who goes, okay, Bill, we'll send you, and we'll pay to 20G for your 2 years. But by the way, you owe us 2 years, or else you got to give us $10,000 back. So I don't see how that same thing doesn't happen in for a basketball player in college. I mean, there's an investment there, right?
I totally agree with you, but. You know, all of these top flight coaches are kind of like pirates.
Oh, yeah.
And they're not great guys for making up rules, because a lot of them are in the business of kind of breaking rules. So they're going to figure out what they can do to get their deal set, and they're not going to worry about cleaning up Dodge City or making rules that are, you know, consistent. Because a lot of these places, you know, the guy that's running around that's saying this is Nick Saban, now that he's not coaching. But they're all saying, well, Saban, when you were the coach, you were cleaning up. And now that everybody else can get access to these five-star kids like you did, now you want to make some rules. So I think it needs to be cleaned up just for a competitive situation. You know, me and my Marquette friends, you know, we kind of wonder. And even though Marquette's been a decent team the last couple of years, with Shaka Smart, he doesn't use the portal at all. His thing is, I'm going to recruit high school kids. I'm going to develop them. He only lost one kid this cycle who wasn't any good. So he's keeping his team together. And
Currently.
Yeah, I mean, so far. And
what if he is... The five didn't he have the five really good freshmen the 1 year? Was it 2-3 years ago? He had all the good freshmen and sophomores.
He had some good players, and you know they ended up staying with him for a while. A few of them went to the NBA, and you know they're doing okay.
Well, I'm saying it, but if all of a sudden he gets five really good recruits, I really like the guy. But if he gets five really good recruits, and you know, they play. As a freshman, he's developing them. They play as sophomores. It looks like these guys are going to the moon. And all of a sudden, five guys get bought by somebody else. He's not going to be too happy.
No, I totally agree. But so far, he's able to keep these guys in tow. And I'm not sure how he does it. Because, again, maybe just none of them are that good. But they had a kid last year, Cam Jones, I think, that was pretty good. Kind of a NBA first, second rounder guy that if somebody, but they ended up paying him NIL money. He's willing to pay some NIL money to people he develops. He's just not out, you know, working the portal to bring guys in.
Well, if they're an Adidas school, Adidas come up with some money to not lose your players.
And that may be happening. And I'm not, you know, not, I don't know the details enough to know, but.
Well, that kid last year, the year before, that kid Hartman who came from Vanderbilt to Notre Dame, he just happened to have a $1 or $2 million Under Armour deal. Well, they didn't give him an Under Armour deal to go to Oregon or Nike school.
Right.
I wouldn't think.
No, it's a tricky world, and
it's even, I think it's trickier for women versus the guys, because the women have, how can I say this without somebody shooting me in the studio? Women have, let's say, other talents, in the sense that Hidalgo, the young lady at Notre Dame, gets a thing from Red Bull. Well, she's very articulate. She's adorable. She's a great basketball player. The company wants her. They want her picture, and they don't mind her being the face of Red Bull. I mean, why wouldn't they?
She's kind of like a model.
Yeah.
Like.
Oh God, yeah. And the whole team was in a State Farm commercial. They're all articulate. They're all attractive. They all go to school. They're like the girl you want to bring home to Ma, for God's sake. But that's a whole different program than just paying somebody to play basketball. They actually, I mean, hey, if I could get the Notre Dame girls team to be in a PTI commercial, I'd do it in a second. Why wouldn't I want those people being my customers of the future? It's a whole different program, I think, in some ways than the guys just getting paid, never really doing anything for anybody. I mean, what did Hartman do for Under Armour? I don't think $1 million worth, do you?
No. Well, I think the whole women's sports thing is definitely coming on. You know, people are watching the games more. And I myself like watching a women's basketball game from time to time. It's kind of interesting. It's a different kind of game, but it's kind of interesting. So
I mean, it's like us playing at the Quonset. None of us can jump.
That's right.
I mean, pretty much, right?
That's exactly right.
But it's very good fundamental basketball. It's a lot of like most guys' high schools.
Right.
I mean, people play serious ball, but they, you know, they're not. Anyway, Bill, thank you very much. Good stuff. Are you golfing today?
I got a few things to do. It's around the house, so I'm going to lay low. But I'll be getting back out there soon.
All right. Take care of yourself, buddy. Thank you for subbing. We'll be back next week. SP Futures down 14. NASDAQ Futures down 25. We're going to have a real quick break, and we'll be back with Wayne and Andrew, hopefully.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called...
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Hello, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 10. NASDAQ Futures down 13 after two huge days to the upside. Some of the Dow being down here is IBM down $15 after earnings, even though I think they came out with pretty good earnings. They just didn't like them so much. But Salesforce up 660. Other stocks not really moving much in the Dow today. But we've been up huge the last couple of days, especially the Magnificent Seven, making huge comebacks. I mean, we had NVIDIA, I think at 95, and now it's back to 103. And again, it's $8 times 25 billion shares outstanding. It's a lot of money. Apple, same way. Apple was well under 200. Now it's 204. Do we have Wayne? Do we have Andrew? Do we have anybody?
You do. Good morning from the banks of the Potomac.
How are you, bud?
Doing good. Boy, I love that earlier segment you had with Kevin.
Oh, you mean with Bill Moriarty?
Oh, yeah. Well, you were talking about what goes through the minds of an active trader with the news. A tremendous combination.
Well, it's a... I mean, the... Andrew, when we used to model, the people at the University of Chicago, tried to put an option pricing model together, right? And people have been trying to do it for, like, a really long time. And finally... Black-Scholes came out with a model, and it works, and it was able to put in calculators. People didn't have, you know, handheld phones at the time. And it basically, there's always been something. The assumption always was that your information stream was continuous. Okay, so the amount of news that came out every day were just random blips all day long and didn't really affect the market in terms of individual stocks on a discrete basis. It was continuous. Well, obviously, it takes 2 seconds for you to think, well, wait a minute, that's not the way it works. I mean, there's going to be days where there's pre-announcements, there's going to be days where on a company number, there's going to be days where there's pre-announcements, there's going to be days when there's earnings, which obviously are a big day. I mean, they may not turn out to be a big day, but the stock could be unchanged, but by and large, there's a big chunk of information that comes out all at once, and it's anything but continuous. Now, for the rest of the market, the assumption was, okay, well, stuff happens every day. There's always going to be a president, there's always going to be Congress, we hope. And this every day there's something's happening, right? I mean, and so you make this assumption. But even that is kind of the wrong assumption. I mean, the Fed doesn't raise or lower rates every day. The Fed doesn't, you know, make an emergency raise or lower rates every day. You're not going to have a president make an announcement every day normally. So these models all get kind of screwed up. So whenever you're talking about things that are discrete, and I mentioned earlier about the guys in Mexico that were in the know moved their pesos offshore the night that the stuff was devalued. When they brought it back, they were 10 or 15% richer than the guy next door. I mean, when what we've seen happen recently, you maybe could be in Washington, may have some idea, but if I went to the saloon downstairs tonight or over at Ceres where all the traders used to hang out and started talking about people making money on a 10% move in the U.S. dollar, they think I had five heads. And yet, that is, the international currency market is by far the biggest market in the world, right? And if you have any kind of wind that's going to move, my God, the money you can make. I mean, it's crazy, right? So, I mean, a lot of this stuff, I mean, I just try and get this out there to people. A lot of this stuff, these are tradable events. And when you have something the other day, like the Secretary of the Treasury having the closed-door meeting with the Chase Manhattan Investors Club, good Lord. I mean, I don't, that may have happened. I mean, I'm not naive enough to think that people didn't use inside information, you know, before I started looking at it. But to have the balls to admit to it, nobody would have done that 30 years ago, I don't think. Do you?
Well, exactly. In fact, Paul Krugman's column yesterday, and he left the New York Times because he thought they were, intervening in his columns. So he quit in December, and now he's on Substack. But his main point of his column yesterday was, why is the Treasury Secretary giving inside information to a private investors group in Washington with no media there? Isn't this an incredible conflict of interest and benefit to the handpicked people in that room?
Well, yeah, and it's actually, I'm sure you know this, but there were times when I first started in the business, and you know, before I was in it, there were, back when you didn't have allegedly free commissions and those kinds of things, people essentially selected, and you didn't have indexes. There was no OEX, there was no Spider, there was no none of that stuff. So, you had to pick stocks. If you thought the market was going up, when I first started, there were no ETFs, there were no stock futures. So if all of a sudden something came out that was incredibly bullish, you and I would go buy IBM or something that was considered, you know, IBM, GM, GE, something that was considered the biggest stocks in the market, that if the world got better, these guys would participate. Well, sometimes we were wrong on that, right? But most of the time, there were a group of 3, 4, 5 stocks, that maybe Kodak was in there and a couple others. Kodak, wow. That were big enough, Exxon maybe, at the time, was it even Exxon? It might have been, you know, Standard Oil. But that's what you did. But then they came out, and everybody had their, like, if you were at Morgan Stanley or if you were at whatever firm it happened to be, there were analysts there that absolutely had their eye on the ball at IBM. So every stock, I mean, we knew, used to know this on the trading floor, every stock had the best analysts. A best meaning they might have gotten a little bit inside information from the company, they might have done something. And the company would routinely, I won't say give people inside information, but somehow it got out there. And then we had this huge law that came into effect. I don't know, Greg, if you're listening, find out when Reg FD was passed, will you? I'm going to say, where are we, 2025? I'm going to say 2007. Maybe give or take 5 years. Reg FD was, and it was full disclosure, which means a company couldn't have an analyst meeting and say, it looks like, you know, after 2 months of the quarter, sales are down a little bit. Unless you put it out to everybody, you couldn't even if there were 50 analysts in the room, you couldn't put that out and assume it got out to everybody. You had to give it out, you know, on wires, basically. And it was known as it's still in place as Reg FD. So no company does that anymore for fear they're going to get caught. Yet the rules don't seem to apply to people in government, does it?
Well, exactly. And you've jogged my memory from a past life when I was head of a high-tech trade association. And we used to put on conferences and conventions, including a big tech symposium at the Fairmont Hotel in Silicon Valley. And to invite anybody from government, we would, of course, have to pay their airfare and for a night or two at a hotel. And the rule was it had to be a widely attended event, whatever that means. But it was enforced. And so we would try to make it seem like, yeah, people had to pay to come to our convention, but anybody could come and hear the government official. And otherwise, they couldn't come and speak. And the type of things that they'd say were not things like, well, we're not going to enforce tariffs against China.
Yeah.
Market-moving statements. It'd be incremental, tiny things about potential policies. But it had to be a widely attended event. And this conference that the Treasury Secretary spoke at, it was clients of J.P. Morgan. That's not a widely attended event. But who's going to enforce anything?
Well, did you think he got paid?
Well, Krugman raises that point, but he says, you would think no, but who knows?
Well, it could just be that the bank gave Trump $1 million, and it's part of that deal.
Well, exactly, because one of the things we're learning, and I try to study this stuff, is that it's, you know, things were never perfect. And, you know, Robert Caro has written about people bringing shopping bags filled with money to Lyndon Johnson, you know, 80 years ago or something like that. It's not like that anymore, because you don't need to fill up a grocery bag with bills. There's all kinds of intermediate ways of helping somebody that can be explained away, and it's too complicated for anybody to even report on.
The part that's swinging me here is there's always been immoral people. There's always been cheating, right? We know that. We've been around the block enough to know. But there's, I think Lyndon Johnson, much as I can't, you know, the guy's memory just bothers me, but knew that was wrong, but he was an immoral guy and said, okay, if you're going to give me money, you better put it in a paper bag where it can't be traced. I don't want to check, right? At least he knew it was wrong and he acted accordingly. It sounds weird, doesn't it? But now, I think these guys are amoral. They don't even think it's wrong. Or if they do, they don't think anybody can catch them.
Exactly. And I've got a great illustration of that, again, from Robert Caro. And since we're talking about radio, in one of his books, he talks about when Johnson was Senate Majority Leader and he was able to get a radio station in Texas and get the FCC and really strong-arm the FCC to raise it from, 500 watts to 10,000 watts clear channel.
It's a big deal.
And then he had his wife, Lady Bird, as ostensibly the owner of it, but Johnson himself would pressure advertisers from around the country to go to this Texas radio station and buy ads. And so that illustrates your point. And I remember, because I follow the FCC very closely, that the seven pages in the Caro book about this, no one can ever think of the public interest standard and FCC regulation the same way again if you've read those seven or eight pages of how Johnson worked around the conflict of interest rules and would just say, that Lady Bird, she's a wonderful businesswoman. I just look in awe at what she's accomplished, when it's really was him.
Well, do you think that Wendy Graham, I think she probably was a pretty bright lady, do you think she gets the job as the head disciplinarian at Enron, or the compliance committee, or else the head of the compliance? Do you think she gets that job without the guy being in Senate?
Oh, why am I laughing? It's not funny, yeah. But it kind of is. It laughs on us.
Yeah, well, yeah. But here's, when did this all become, I mean, you know, without us just picking on one side of the aisle, I mean, when Janet Yellen left the job she was Federal Reserve Chief. She was the head Powell's job. And when she left for the next year or so, I actually have a list here, she went to every firm, essentially, that she was supposed to be regulating, either banks or Citadel or places like that, and got $250,000, somewhere between $150,000 and $275,000 per speech. This is, you know, it's a few years ago. This is back when that was real money. And she picked up, what, $7 million in a year from people she was, and I, you know, I'm sorry. She's probably a terrific lady. I don't know. I wouldn't pay 40 cents to hear her talk. When did she ever give a speech that was worth listening to? And she's not Bill Clinton when it comes to speaking, or somebody like that. Which I guess maybe is okay. You know, it's the spoils of war of being in that spot. But the thought that she was hired back into government after that payoff to supervise essentially the same people she just got the money from, how does anybody justify that? That has a moral sell.
Ben Bernanke went to Citadel.
Well, okay, but he got hired by a firm. He didn't go back into government. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, that her getting the money in the first place was positive, or if she'd have taken a job at Merrill Lynch or someplace, I'd have problems with that. But the fact that she went back into government to regulate the same people again, how do you regulate somebody who just gave you $500,000? I mean, even if you can, it looks bad, doesn't it?
Well, not to try to butter you up even more than I ordinarily do, but there need to be independent voices like yours who say this isn't right. But what one of the things that's happened is newspapers are pulling their punches. Let's get to the sports metaphor here. Is, you know, we used to look for newspapers particularly, but maybe 60 Minutes or something like that, to expose this and make people say, this isn't right. And that was the check. And now we have the executive producer of 60 Minutes just quit this week because he says the ownership is making him pull their punches.
Well, I'm sure they are. The part that bothers me, and Greg and I are good buddies. He helps out all this, but sometimes I get a different point of view from people of different age groups right now. Some of the younger people, I'm not going to accuse Greg of that, are so, I want the word, they're, it's like they've been in a rock concert for 5 hours and heard all this huge noise, and they walk out and they don't seem to know what's right and what isn't. I mean, it's not like they don't. It's not like they're going to pick your pocket. What am I saying? It's not like if you leave a dollar on the desk, they're going to take it. They're not. I mean, they're honest people. I don't think they know that this is wrong. I mean, they've never or it's been their entire life. All they do have seen it like this, and can't believe somebody like us says it's wrong, because look, it goes on every day, and nobody seems to stop it. I mean, we have Dick Durbin retiring, right? And he's at age 80. He's not going to run for another term.
I don't think it's new.
No, I mean, but what I'm saying, Greg, it's never been new. It's never been
right.
It's never been that there's not been a crook. But there was a time when, if you and I were crooks, we at least didn't tell everybody about it like it was okay. I mean, if we gave a private...
I think Barron Trump's going to be one of the richest people ever, including his dad, because...
Well, I'm saying, but if you and I were sleazy enough...
All that information.
If you and I were sleazy enough to hold a seminar for rich people and get paid for it and give them government information, the last thing we would do is be proud of it 20 years ago. Not that it didn't happen. I mean, am I right on this? You know, I mean, am I right that it's not about that it didn't happen. People always, there always were bad people. But now it seems like, I don't care if anybody knows, Reg FD doesn't apply to me. Okay, why is that necessarily? I mean, that's why I'm having trouble with this whole mess. It's not that people have done bad things. It's the fact that now it seems like, so what? Do something about it. I mean, look how many people in Congress are trading every day. Is that even a full-time job for some of these people?
Yeah, exactly, including some. Well, everybody claims to be a big reformer, but if you look at the list of the most active traders, you see, well, to both sides, the list I saw was equally divided between the parties.
Oh, yeah.
And many of them are very publicly righteous about the need for reform on both sides. And the reason that they have money to trade with is because some people believe that they're reformers. So they got all this money, and it turns out they're doing trading. One guy, Ro Khanna, I think the story said he's done 4,000 trades. Maybe you brought this up.
6,400 last year.
Yeah.
I bet that's more than I've done, and that's what I do for a living. I'd have to ask my brother. I mean, I bet I'm right about at that number. But it's my full-time job, and I have clients.
Well, I'm speechless at those statistics.
Well, I mean, even the guys that are... one guy was at 500. Okay, that's 2.5 trades a day. That's a lot for a retail person.
Hey, Tom, it's Wayne here. I'm sorry I jumped in late. But
that's okay.
I've been checking the betting pools for who the next Pope's going to be.
Are you on the list?
You have to be an observant member of the Catholic Church, which I'm not. But you do not have to, interestingly enough, you do not have to be a member of the clergy.
Right.
To be selected as the Pope.
It's sort of like the Speaker of the House.
Yeah, same thing. And, you know, so there's a meme going around that, you know, Dark Brandon, a.k.a. Joe Biden, could be a dark horse candidate.
Okay. That's amazing. We've been talking a little bit about the change in, you know, how the Treasury Secretary doesn't seem to know about Reg FD. And I guarantee you, as the head of Cantor Fitzgerald, he knows all about Reg FD. But now some people are now just above. But and there's going to be somebody.
He put his kid in charge of the crypto thing.
Yeah,
you know,
well.
That's another.
Well, there's going to be somebody who writes in to Greg and says, you know, tell the chief he's nuts. What about Nancy Pelosi? I'll tell you. She might, in her heart of hearts, been a crook. You know, I don't know the lady. But the information she traded on was probably pretty good stuff about some companies doing better over the next year or two, and it's information I'd love to have, but I'll flat out tell anybody. And Greg knows this. I'm not pumping my own horn, because I'll tell you what, trading for people and trying to beat the market is really, really hard. And when I do it, I'm happy, and once in a while I don't. I mean, it's just the way the world is. But the only difference is I admit it. tell you what, you gave me this information. Andrew Wayne, you put $100,000 in an account. You gave me this information last week. If that account wasn't worth $2 million, I'd quit myself. I'd quit myself. That's how valuable this information is. I've never seen anything like this, ever. This is not on a plane of Nancy Pelosi getting minority wages, minimum wage, not in the tuna fish industry and buying more of her husband's stock in StarKist. This is not like this that at all. This is on a plane I've never seen. I mean, am I wrong? Greg, am I wrong or right? Could we have made some money in the last week knowing this crap?
Yeah. That just the on a one lot, you know, if you were trading the bonds or even call it S&Ps, you know, you'd be well into probably $25,000.
Yeah, one lot.
Well, and here's a big difference, is if Nancy Pelosi had inside information, and it's a sliding scale, so let's just assume everybody's got some inside information up there. But if she had a press conference, that's not going to move the markets in 24 hours by $1 trillion or more dollars.
No. No, as I say, it's not even close.
And then if she said, well, never mind, the next day, and it moves $1 trillion in the next 24 hours, that's not happening historically. I can't think with anybody.
Well, the $8 move up and down in NVIDIA, $8 in NVIDIA is times 25 billion is what? $200 billion in NVIDIA. Valuation up and down in the last 3 days. I can tell you moves like this, long-term capital, Iraq war, those kinds of things, I've never seen them back and forth like this where people change their mind on something. You know, it could be that Trump himself, you know, just wanders out of the can in the morning, picks up his machine and types something in there. He may be, you know, in his own world, and that. But I'll tell you what, if he told anybody before he was going to say it, you can't tell me the head of Cantor Fitzgerald doesn't know how valuable this is. I mean, Trump may not know, or maybe he's...
Yeah, you'd think everything would be more copacetic with all that insider knowledge. Apparently, a few days ago, a fist fight almost broke out between the Treasury Secretary and Elon Musk in the Oval Office, and I guess they were told to take their argument out to the hallway, and they continued to go at each other there. So I don't know. These guys should be happy and not trying to fight each other if they're making loads and loads of money, but maybe they're just being greedy too.
Well, it's just like on the trading floor. You used to have to go down to the horse if you wanted to fight. You never fought on the trading floor, you could find, but if you went to the horse, it was okay. And people would start down there, and by the time they get down there, we'd talk them out of it, and they'd come back up the escalator. I don't know if any... There probably was one or two actual real biffs out there, but most of the time they got solved just leave, because nobody wanted to leave the pit because there was no money to be made outside,
right?
But I started to talk about Dick Durbin retiring. We're gonna go break here in a couple minutes, but when he started, he says this would be his, he's been there what, 5 terms, so that's 30 years. I'm gonna say when he was in there, guys like some of the World War II guys were probably in there. I don't know if Dan Inouye was still there or a few other people.
Well, Bob Dole was definitely there.
I mean, these guys, they seem like morally they were somewhat of a cut above. And now all of a sudden, I mean, all this, the people's total, I won't say total, but a lot of lack of respect for some of the people in there. All they're doing is getting greedy. All they're doing is making money. I don't think Durbin ever did that. I mean, I don't know the guy that well. I don't know him at all. But I don't know that he was ever... in that group. How do you let the institution that you obviously given your life to, how do you let the institution go down that road and you get tarred with that same brush without doing something about it? And if the three of us were in the house, I mean, I on the trading floor, I didn't want people to break the rules. I didn't want to be part of a group that did nothing but break the rules.
They always say the Senate is the most exclusive club in the world after, of course, the club of ex-presidents. Thinking back, there's a lot of rancor, and justifiably so, with some of these this guy from Oklahoma, for example, who you know, wanted to stand up and get in a fist fight during a hearing, I think, with the head of the Teamsters Union, Mark Wayne Mullen. But you know, looking back at history, there were some real characters in the Senate in the 30s and into the 40s who, for example, Senator Theodore Bilbo from Mississippi, he was an out-and-out Confederate and wanted to reintroduce slavery. So we've had these knuckleheads in the Senate for a long time, but I think this idea that, oh, it's a club of 100, it's very exclusive, I think sometimes it goes to their head.
Well, let's go to break and let's continue after break. SP Futures down 7, NASDAQ Futures up 12. Because to me, it's exactly like being on a trading floor. If all of a sudden there's 50, if we'd had 25 cases where people were indicted for stealing on the options exchange floor, everybody who looked at me would never say, well, that's 25 out of 1,200. The rest of the guys are clean. That's not the way people think. They would have looked at me and said, oh, you're one of those options traders. By the way, when's your court date? Right? That's the way people would act. And none of us wanted that to happen. And I'm just kind of surprised these guys. Look, like I say, after break, let's deal with it. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right here.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. So, Greg, in summary, are we pissed off that there's inside information, or are we pissed off that we don't have it?
Better to be pissed off than pissed on.
Yeah. God, S&P futures down 10, NASDAQ futures down 7, Dow futures down 194. Most of that has become of IBM here. I thought the earnings were pretty good, Greg, and they were up. That's why these earnings, I keep saying, the one piece of information that I think Greg and I probably almost don't give a crap about is earnings. I mean, Tesla's numbers were horrible, and the stock's been straight up, right? And, of course, they was added to it, the fact that what's-his-name supposed to go back and run the place. But IBM's earnings, I think,
that's
pretty good.
That's on Polymarket, too. When will he depart?
Doge or Tesla?
Doge.
I think, well, he's sort of already out. I think
he's out. July, I think it's 40%.
I think when he lost the race in Wisconsin.
It was an opportunity for you.
Yeah, it's a... Anyway, over in Europe, we've got... Now, man, these guys have been up and down like us. DAX down 54.2, FTSE down 11.1, CAC round down 12.1, so... Small to the downside over there. Over in Asia, Nikkei up 170.5%, Hang Seng down 162.7%, Shanghai unchanged at 32.97%. Shanghai's been really, really not doing anything the last week or so. Bonds down 4 basis points, 4.34%. Now again, these guys were shooting up on Monday. The 30-year rate, if you want to find out what that one is, that's the TYX. I had it 4.98 or something on Monday, almost 5%. Now we're back down to 4.74. So that's kind of a big move. Oil up 70 cents, but still 62.97. Craig, where's all these guys claiming $100 oil? I hope they're not positioned that way because they're not doing so hot. Brent up 62 cents, 66.74. Natural gas down 5 cents, 2.97. It's down from $4 in probably 8 weeks. RBOB up a penny, 2.09. Gold, which had been getting flying down, is up today. It's bouncing back, up $55, $33.50. I think the record was 34.40, something like that, but we're not that far off it. Silver down 4 cents, 33.49. Was odd yesterday. Gold was down 2.5%, and silver was up 4%. That's kind of an unusual thing. That'd drive your metal traders to the wall. Greg, FX, foreign exchange, this is the big number. The pound up again today, 113.7. Euro, 113.7, like Bill was saying earlier, was 102 not that long ago. 10% moves in currency is a big deal. The pound is 133. It was 128 for a while. It isn't as big a move as the euro, but it's gone the same way. Crypto, this has been heading up, not today, but still 92,757. Down 658 is Bitcoin. Yeah, a lot of stuff there. What do you got for us, Traffic Brothers Sports? The Cubs.
Morning, everyone.
World Series bound. You got your tickets?
7:36 here in Chicago. We've got 54 degrees right now. High of 63 today. Cool and pleasant. Phoenix, 67 now. High of 92 today. Lots of sun. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 35 minutes. From Lake Cook, 51 minutes. From Wolf to the interchange, 46 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 26 minutes, and the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 41 minutes. NHL, Washington beat the Canadiens. That was 3-1. Washington's up 2-0. Stars beat the Avs. That was overtime, 2-1. Dallas leads that series 2-1. Yeah. Kings beat the Oilers 6-2. LA leads 2-0. And MLB, Sox lose to Twins. That was 3-6. Diamondbacks lose to the Rays. And the Cubs beat the Dodgers. That was 7-6 at home. That's all I got, guys.
So, guys, is there any chance, you know, whenever you think with your heart, I'd really like to see the Warriors with Jimmy Buckets, one of my favorite players on the Bulls, and Steve Kerr, again, one of my favorite players, who's now the coach there, pull the upset against Houston.
Well, that series tied 1-1.
I know. Houston's—they're too big. I don't see them doing it. I think they might come close, but again, another team I'd like to see win. I think it's going to lose. What do you think? Just saying.
It's 1-1.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying I thought they might be able to get two out of those guys, but they didn't. Those guys are huge. Where'd they get those people? Plus, a couple of them are ugly. Not that I'm, you know, Robert Redford, but anyway. So, guys, what we were talking. Before, I mean, my representative, I've met him years ago when he first ran, Mike Quigley, because he's a good friend with Dr. J's wife, Bridget, who was a judge at the time, and so I met him through her. If I'm Mike Quigley, I don't know how clean he is. I think he's pretty clean. I would want to have people walk up to me in a coffee shop and say, hey, Mike, how much money did you make trading last year like all the other bleeps? I wouldn't want that question. I would say something. Or is that just me? I mean, how do these guys put up with the guys around them doing this crap? Is there no? I guess the real question I wanted to ask you guys today. I'll go back to all these alleged rules. You weren't supposed to trade if you're in office. You're supposed to put your stuff in a blind trust. Were those gentlemen's agreements to be tossed out? House rules, Senate rules to change anytime you feel like it? Were they laws? Were they conventions? Because now they're just all gone. I mean, maybe publicly starting with Cheney saying, screw that, I'm trading when I'm a vice president. When did it all break apart, and what broke apart? Just gentlemen agreements? Were they rules? Did they change the law? I have no idea what these things were. I know that's the way people used to behave, but now they don't.
Well, it depends what venue, I think, we're talking about. So let's stick with the House. So there's a House Ethics Committee, and the people who would volunteer for that, historically, you've got to be either more honest than the average person, likely, to want to get involved in that, because you know that you're going to be held under a big microscope no matter what you do. And so the people who volunteer for that historically tend to be more honest, civic-minded from both parties than the average person. But with the diminution of ethics, accountability, whether from the press or otherwise, they have tremendous pressure to wink and ignore evidence depending on who they're investigating. And so, for example, Wayne is a huge expert on Matt Gaetz, for example, and I don't know whether we want to get into it here, but ultimately the House Ethics Committee issued a report on Gaetz that helped drive him out of office. He's a Florida congressman who Trump named to be attorney general. And as Wayne and readers of his column have known for years, the big findings of the House Ethics Committee that were ultimately leaked that helped drive Gaetz out of office didn't even include some of the fairly easily documented abuses that were just too hot to handle. Wayne, I don't know if you want to comment on either the specifics there, or more important, the larger process I've described. But it goes back to other parties. I'll just add one thing historically, that when I first got to know Wayne probably 15 years ago, there was this huge ethics investigation of a Democrat from upstate New York who Wayne and I both became friendly with, and it was a big phony deal. And the guy tried to fight it, and he couldn't go anywhere. Sticking with the House, the issue is, are they really going to investigate, and are they going to do it in a non-political way?
We're on a little bit of different... Remember when Kirk and Spock used to play chess, they had three different levels of the chessboard? We're on a slightly different level. I mean, I know you guys know more about this. I'm saying on a personal level, why doesn't a Mike Quigley walk into... If you ever have a session of the House where nobody else can be in there but the House, say, look, you bleeps, I got asked four times last time I was home how much I'm trading. I'm tired of taking crap from you guys. Sometimes it's really hard for me to get points across. I don't know if it's my Catholic upbringing or what. What's changed, Andrew and Wayne and Greg, I think is not the fact that people didn't sneak a trade in or a bucket of a bag of money or something. It's the guy from California, what's his name, Roe something something?
Roe Conant.
He's got the 6,400 trades are right out there. He doesn't care. It's not like he's trying to hide it. It's one thing for, you know, I'm not going to say 30 years ago when we all were chased. It's one thing for me to know it's wrong, still do my 10 trades a year on really good ones and make some dough and try and have it in my wife's account or my kid's account or some fun. They don't even try and hide it. I mean, you could never have... I'm going to say in 1995, if somebody was right out there on everybody's face, we're not talking about an ethics committee or anything, if there was a newspaper said, hey, this guy Wayne Matson is supposed to be a representative, the guy's making 40 trades a day, what the bleep? The guy would have been, he would have resigned himself, I think. Now they don't care. That's the part I don't get, the total change in morality.
Well, you got Marjorie Taylor Greene actually bragging about the inside trade she's doing. And does anybody try to discipline her? Well, with the close margin that the Republicans have in the House, you're not going to get Speaker Mike Johnson to do anything. And there's some question about what he's making on the side.
The way they've accomplished it, if you guys are in town tonight, we'd go out and have a cocktail. We usually do on Thursday night. And a bunch of the younger guys come by that work for Reg and for OCC and things. They come by and they always sit at our table because they like sitting with old traders. I'm going to say, in those guys' minds, the fact that this is out there, public knowledge, and nothing happens, must mean it's okay. The mentality, I'm not blaming them at all for thinking that way, because I'm sitting there going, well, there can't be something wrong with it. It's right here. I'm looking right at it. There's been a... Have they changed the perception? Have people just don't go to church? I mean, what is it?
I think the media bears some responsibility in this. You know, don't expect to see any exposés of congressional stock trading on 60 Minutes. But years ago, the press, before there was even an ethics committee in either of the two chambers, It was the press that used to go after these guys. And Andy knows about Senator Owen Brewster from Maine, and it was Drew Pearson and Jack Anderson who basically outed him.
This is 70, 80 years ago in the early 50s, and he was a very righteous U.S. senator, and his big thing was he could only afford two shirts, and he'd wash them in his sink, and he was so dedicated and everything. And Jack Anderson, in his memoir in the early 70s, he said, I went to my mentor, Drew Pearson. I said, this is the 64th column we've written about him losing $5,000 in a Pullman car on a train when somebody picked his pocket. Isn't that a little much? And Drew Pearson said, look, he was coming from a poker game where he played with lobbyists. He says, we're telling our readers exactly what they need to know about this guy, and whether it's, we've mentioned it 60 times or 100, we're telling them he plays poker with lobbyists. Do you think he loses?
No, I'm thinking probably not.
And to bring it up to the current times, and just so your listeners know how some of your guests spend their time, Wayne has tracked closely the $3,000 that the Homeland Security Secretary lost Sunday night. Wayne, do you want to talk about that?
Well, yeah. So Kristi Noem, the Homeland Security Secretary, was out at a restaurant in D.C., and she placed her Gucci bag on the floor, and some guy in a table next to her, they said, who was wearing a medical mask, kept inching closer and closer, and then snatched her bag and ran off with it. And she said inside this purse was $3,000 in cash, her access card for the Homeland Security Department, security badge, blank checks. And now, I mean, back before ATMs and these debit cards, yeah, I used to carry a few blank checks around in case I needed to get some cash or pay for some groceries, but who uses those these days? And whole story sounds fishier and fishier every new detail we get.
She's supposed to have home Secret Service protection.
She did. She had
and
two
she's
agents.
At a burger restaurant when somebody walks off with her purse.
She also had her passport in it. Now, $3,000 in cash and her passport. I've been thinking about calling ICE and have them get her, because...
Now, when you say 3,000, does that mean you and Andrew always carry five and you're wondering why it's only three, or you think it's not a lot?
Well, she also was down at the prison in El Salvador with the caged people as a photo display behind her, and she had a $50,000 Rolex watch. Okay. You're thinking, wait a second, isn't she like a governor before she came?
Oh, yeah. But I guess, Andrew, you made a comment that it's not going to happen in 60 minutes. All right, so let's say 60 minutes comes on and they interview me, for instance, just as a, and I'll say, gee, we have a small money management brokerage firm here, and we do trades for people and those kinds of things. And they'd say, well, gee, you've got a few people there that seem to know what they're doing, and that's their job to trade. And they'd say, well, how many trades did you guys do for people last year? Not the stuff that people do on their own, because there are a lot of those people too. And if I were to come up with a number like, gee, between my brother and me and a couple other guys here, we did 5,000 trades for other people. You know, some people got this stock and we're doing covered rights, but whatever. And all of a sudden you get a representative that did six by himself. I mean, I guess there's one thing you guys are sort of assuming maybe I would be too, that if the story got out there, there would be moral outrage. I wonder if 60 Minutes doesn't do the story because most people are going to say, so what? They don't even know that this is kind of really wrong to be doing this. Now, how many trades? There's 200 trades in a day. What's that, 30 trades a day that somebody does while they're supposed to be being a rep? That's kind of a lot. I don't do 30 trades a day, for God's sake.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that ultimately it comes back to the public. And in fact, I've just been thinking about that, Tom, because somehow I got invited to a high-level discussion tomorrow on the future of the news. And I'm thinking, well, what? And this is associated with the big White House Correspondents' Dinner. A lot of people have events. And I'm thinking, what am I going to say, or what's my contribution to this? And I was just brainstorming this morning that one thing I've seen that's hurt the news media is that there used to be, when all of us started our careers, a sense that, okay, you get an expose out there and authorities will pick up on it and the public will care and there will be reform. Large or small, or at least people will think and hope that there's action. Whereas if you remove the concept that a story might have consequences because the public doesn't care, then not only does that hurt the country and the community, but why should people read newspapers if nothing's going to come of it?
Well, it's down to basics. Now, I don't like doing this, but I'm gonna go gross here. If somebody gets arrested after a Cub game or something for, you know, peeing in the alley behind your house, everybody's gonna go, I don't want that. I got kids. I'm trying to teach people how to, you know, act normally and how people are supposed to live together. We don't want everybody peeing in the goddamn alley. What if it got to the point where, you know, so what? Everybody pees in the alley. So what? Why is that even a story? I mean, I wondered if we're getting to that stage. What do you mean? Last night I came home after two too many beers and I didn't feel like going to the house. I peed in the alley. Well, I didn't, by the way. What if everybody just did it? And all of a sudden people go, what's the problem? I mean, I'm wondering if we're reaching that stage. And it's not a stage I want to reach.
Well, you're right. Let's pick on this Ro Khanna out in California to illustrate your point. All right, so he's doing all these trades. He represents Silicon Valley and all those big shots. By coincidence, Wayne and I knew his predecessor, who was a really nice guy, former school teacher, Mike Honda, that we met years ago. And Khanna is affiliated with the Bernie Sanders movement. And so he's got a kind of nationwide voice, Khanna does. And he's a big reformer. And he overwhelmed this former school teacher in the congressional Democratic primary years ago. And so it really doesn't matter if you have a reputation for being a reformer, what the specifics are, unless the public digs into it and cares.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things that I'm concerned about on this mess. It's obviously come by my questioning, I hope it's come through, is I don't understand why the honest senators and Republicans, or senators and representatives, I don't see why they put up with it so they get essentially tarred with the same brush. I wouldn't. I may, you know, I might resign, I might do something, but I'm not going to go to dinner ever again and have three people ask me how many trades I'm making on inside information.
Well, first of all, they don't go to dinner that often in any place that somebody can see them. They go to fundraisers.
Okay, I get it. But I'm saying,
often 7 or 8 a night. That's why a lot of them, at least in the older days, have drinking problems, because they're going to 7 or 8 receptions a night when they're in town, and everybody says, Senator, let me get your drink. And to be polite, there they go. But I've got a quick anecdote that I think goes to your point. One time I was on a small airplane going from D.C. to New Haven, and I happened to sit next to Rosa DeLauro, the longtime congresswoman from New Haven, Democrat. Her husband, Stan Greenberg, is a big time, used to be a big time Democratic pollster. And I started talking about what I was doing at that stage of my career as an investigative reporter. And I was probably quoting some findings that Wayne Madsen had had. And she said, "This is horrible. You've got to do something about this." And I said, "Congresswoman, I'm sorry, but I'm just a journalist.
I'm just a schmuck. You're the one who's you're in there."
And here's what she said, I swear. She said, "I can't do anything." Think about that. She was even then a long time, she's still there. So to go to your point, Tom, these people may have less power than we think.
I'm gonna, you know what, you just brought that up. You just brought that up. And I was, actually, that was going to be my theme next week with you guys, but I'll lob it out there, and Greg, write this down. If you get elected, if you're the number one, you know, all of a sudden, I've actually talked to a couple of these guys when I used to do the stuff with the CBOE. We'd go out there and, you know, talk to representatives and stuff. And we'd always have we did one year, we had a big thing in the Capitol. When you used to be able to walk right in, we had a big buffet and, you know, a couple of bars set up and so forth. And I love the staffers being able to go in, they grab a drink, say hello to a few people, grab about 8 shrimp, another drink out the door, and they're not there more than like 40 seconds. I thought,
oh, how dare they? I only laugh because Andy and I both know that our secret of success as a underpaid journalist in Washington is to go to as many of those lunches, dinners, especially the one with the open bars. And I actually thought about bringing some of those Ziploc bags to a couple of them and, you know, pocket a few extra shrimp to, you know, have for dinner for the rest of the week.
Yeah, you don't get any little crackers or tomatoes on it. You go right for the shrimp.
Oh yeah, especially the jumbo shrimp.
But what I'm saying, if one of us were to get elected as a freshman congressperson, what do we do other than vote however somebody tells us, and maybe get on to be the ass end of a crummy committee? What do we do all day?
You're basically worried about keeping your seat, so you're talking to donors, you're talking to various pressure groups. The one thing that's different now, and Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska mentioned this the other day. She said, "Look, a lot of Republicans, myself included, we really can't criticize Trump, for example, because we're afraid of what the ramifications will be." So that's a little bit different. I actually had an exploratory committee back in 2004. I was thinking about going after the Democratic nomination for the 8th District in Virginia, which is the D.C. suburbs, Arlington, Alexandria. And my fundraiser said, "Look, I'm going to get you $250,000. It's pay to play. But here's a list of the things you're going to have to do." And I'm looking down this thing. I said, "Man, I don't agree with some of this." He said, "Yeah, but, you know, you got to do it."
Well, even if Trump supporters are only 20%, you know they're going to vote.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's a problem. I mean,
right.
We actually supported, and then I've let you guys go to next week, but we got a whole bunch of stuff to talk about then. We supported, you know, well, Bobby Rush retired after all these years. And he recommended this lady, Karen Reeves, and she came on the show a couple times. I went to a thing for her in Blue Island, and talk about low on the totem pole. It was like $50 to get in, and so Bobby Rush showed up. I'll tell you what, the guy pulls in next to me in the lot, and I could tell it was you know, plate number one, right? Because it was the first district. And he gets out, and I'm thinking, how did this, he almost bumps into me driving. I'm saying, how the hell is this guy driving? I mean, he was clearly in poor health. Comes in, very nice, and sits down. I mean, he didn't have anything to drink or anything because he was in bad shape. We sit down, and I really took a liking to this lady, Karen Reeves. And she's running. There's 10 people in the primary for his spot. I don't know if you guys knew this, because once in a while I can trump you guys. Not that Trump, Bridge Trump. And he's there, and when he left, I made sure he got out of there. And all of a sudden, he came at us going the wrong way on a runway street. I had to go up on the curb to dodge the guy. Somehow, he made it back to Hyde Park. I don't know how he did, but anyway, she was running pretty strong, and the district had just gotten redone to where it was a lot of the white areas south of I-80 were now her district. And I said, Karen, you have a problem like going to a rodeo or something? And everybody there is like a white Republican. And she goes, I don't have any problem. She goes, I connect with the women. They connect with me. They know I adopted a blind kid. I have the same kind of problem as they do. I have no problem connecting with anybody. I think she's friggin' terrific. Anyway, she and this other person were like neck and neck at the top of the list. Well, Jesse Jackson's other son is also running. So the last week or two, he gets like $1.5 million from the Bitcoin guy who's now in jail. And he ends up winning. And then, of course, he didn't give any of that money back. Durbin and the rest of these guys, when they found out the guy was a crook, they all gave the money back, right? Or a lot of them did. But they didn't. He didn't. And so, but I mean, so this, it's really, but I'm saying, what does he do all day? I mean, he's never going to be the one person who votes with the Republicans. I mean, you don't. What do you even do? They tell you how to vote. They tell you what committee to be on. I mean, I wouldn't want that job. Well, how long are you going to be there before you get to make any policy? Like 20 years?
Oh, yeah. Next week, I'll tell you a story of three-term U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. And just the bottom line is I talked with him in a hallway, and he said he couldn't even call a witness without the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee approving it, and he wanted to get away from me because I was underscoring his lack of power after three terms in the U.S. Senate. He couldn't even get a witness called.
That's unbelievable. You guys, what do you got going this weekend? Everything good? You guys homebodies? Are you in Florida, Wayne?
I'm in Florida and sticking close to home.
Well, when it gets warm down there, where do you go? Do you go weekend in Nantucket or someplace?
I wish I had the fortune to do something like that. No, I get my air conditioner worked on, so I have some. I can survive these terrible summers here.
So Greg and I should not be looking forward to any invites to like Kenny Bunkport or someplace.
Not for me.
Okay, Andrew. How about Andrew? He must have scratch, that guy. No.
No.
Which is worse, a summer in Florida or a summer on the Potomac? For God's sake.
Well, things are heating up here, so there's a lot going on, and we'll get into it.
All right, next week, guys.
At the end of the show.
Next week, we'll have good fun like we did today. SP Futures up 2, NASDAQ Futures up 39. By the way, Bill, wasn't Bill fun for the first hour talking about how all those projects are all done overseas? You don't have a chance to listen, Wayne, but did you, Andrew?
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Well, anyway, it was a good show today, guys. Greg, nice job. Be back tomorrow. Stacks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.